Body Ecology's detoxification training program. This is our sixth class, and today we have Dr. Leonard Smith, who's going to reveal medical secrets and myths about detoxification. We're going to learn the inside scoop on what happens when you're exposed to toxins and the latest methods for detoxifying safely and naturally. Just a little background on Dr. Leonard Smith. He's a renowned gastrointestinal, vascular, and general surgeon, as well as an expert in the use of nutrition and natural supplementation. As a surgeon, Dr. Smith has firsthand experience of the problems associated with faulty digestion and the surgical necessities they can cause. For the past 20 years, Dr. Smith has investigated many holistic medical programs, including nutrition, exercise, chelation, stress management, and the relevance of mental and spiritual attitudes in healing. Acknowledging the effectiveness of whole organic foods and nutritional supplementation, Dr. Smith strives to stay on the leading edge of research and breakthroughs in the field of functional nutrition. So today, it's my pleasure to welcome Donna Gates and Dr. Leonard Smith to today's class. Welcome, Donna. Welcome, Leonard.
Thank you, Heather.
Yeah, it's great to be here, and I'm thrilled that Leonard's on because he's that rare combination, I think, of a doctor who has a great heart and an amazing understanding of nutrition and natural health. So people are in for a treat today.
Absolutely. And, Leonard, one of the things that we wanted to get started with is to really get an understanding of the medical reasons why people get so toxic. I think a lot of these reasons will surprise people because I know that you do advising for the University of Miami's medical department, and you've seen that not all doctors are even aware of these things. So can you talk to us a little bit about that and zero in on what happens in the body when toxins are overloaded?
Well, I would start out by saying I think everybody is clearly exposed to more and more toxins as time goes by, and without getting into the gruesome details, there's, you know, millions of pounds and tons of toxins from everything from fertilizers to chemical processing to waste materials, even toxins from volcanoes and one thing and the other. So, yes, we constantly are exposed to them. We get them through the skin. We certainly get them through breathing. We get it through the liquids we drink and the food we eat. And in addition, because we don't eat necessarily the best food all the time, we actually create more toxins from the food we eat and how they interact with the bacteria in our body, and particularly in our intestinal tract. But I think the reason mainstream medicine doesn't really embrace this is that mainstream medicine, particularly in the United States and Europe, are very much geared towards symptom management. So until people have very clear-cut symptoms, they frequently aren't really taken very seriously. A lot of the constitutional symptoms people have that are becoming toxic are fatigue and muscle aches and pains and difficulty sleeping and difficulty with elimination and mood disorders of one sort or the other. A lot of sort of constitutional or generalized symptoms that doctors generally don't have the time nor the expertise to really deal with. And I would say that toxins, a good analogy would be sort of like termites in a house. You know, you periodically have your house inspected, and they might find a couple, and it doesn't mean anything bad is going to happen to your house, but it's a warning that you need to do something about it. If you don't, little by little, you get a critical mass of toxicity, and then you do have serious problems. And from my experience, I don't think cardiovascular disease, neurological, degenerative disease, cancer, or almost any significant illness doesn't have at least a significant part of its baseline cause is due to cumulative toxicity.
That's really helpful to know, Leonard, because I think that the first thing people are looking for is to be diagnosed with something, and toxins often get overlooked in that. Can you talk about the process of detoxification when you think about the organs of detox and what's happening in the process of detoxification?
Okay, well, I think, first of all, I'd like to mention that the point is there's many different types of toxins, and a lot of people are aware of mercury and lead and cadmium and arsenic, and those are called toxic minerals, and some people call them heavy metals. which I think is a little bit of an archaic name. They're toxic minerals are what they are, but we can get those for sure from everything from coal-burning power plants, which put out a lot of mercury. I guess we could call them mercury-burning, but that's a very common source of mercury. Actually, volcanoes is a large source of mercury. Unfortunately, eating too much fish, particularly the larger predatory fish like tuna and marlin, swordfish, king mackerel, shark, things like that are very high in mercury. And that mercury just comes from the ocean's floor. It's the natural outgassing from the ocean, and the algae pick it up, and then the small fish take the mercury from there right on up the food chain. And, of course, now there's considerable data that really supports the fact that using mercury in fillings creates a fairly significant body burden of mercury. So you've got the toxic minerals, and possibly even more concerning, I think, at this point is the fact we have so many fat-soluble toxins, ranging from things like PCBs and bisphenol A and phthalates and dioxin and benzene, xylene, all these different chemicals. And there's a company out there that I would like to certainly mention. It's called the Environmental Work Group. Their website is EWG.org. But every person they've measured the blood level on have anywhere from 10 to 100 of these types of fat-soluble toxins in their body. So that's a little disconcerting. It appears that maybe we do, for long periods of time, have detoxification pathways that handle these reasonably well, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But certainly the whole toxic burden is something people need to be aware of, and basically eat organic, drink pure filtered water, and start using products in their house for cleaning and on their clothes and everything that is toxin-free. And I think that's the first step. So what does our body do with these toxins? That was what you were asking me. But basically, let's just review quickly the fact that we have many organs of detoxification, starting with the lungs, the skin, the GI tract, the urinary tract, the liver. To some degree, you could even say the prostate and the breast are organs of detoxification because material can come out of those organs as well. In short, virtually every cell in the body has within it detoxification pathways, and it's obviously necessary because whenever anything is taken up into a cell, part of it is used for the cell's benefit. Part of it creates a waste of metabolism, even if it's just carbon dioxide, but there's many other metabolic molecules as a part of metabolism that need to get out of cells. So basically, each of the organs of our body try their best to get the toxins out. The area I'd like to concentrate on, but I would say right off the top, this probably applies for most of the cells in the body. But the area that's been studied the most in terms of detoxification is the liver and the intestines. And they both have within them what's called enzymes that help to take the toxins and basically restructure them so they can get them out of the liver. And so we'll talk about the liver first. And you've got what's called phase one and phase two detoxification pathways. And phase one, and these are just a bunch of chemical names, but it's basically hydration, oxidation, halogenation. There's just several simple biochemical pathways where either a hydrogen, an oxygen, a hydroxyl group, or something is put on a molecule that's come into the liver that needs to get out of the liver. And once it does that, then it actually is picked up by a whole nother network called the phase two detoxification enzymes. And these are truly enzymes like there's amino acid conjugation, glucuronidation, there's sulfation. There's at least six different ones, acetylation. These are just biochemical terms, but basically all it's saying is they're taking that molecule that had already been treated by phase one, and now they're hooking something else onto it so that it can be excreted in the bile. So that's the next step. It's now sitting in the liver cells waiting to be excreted in the bile. And if you have a really healthy liver, that process happens fairly normally, and these toxins then get in the bile and are carried into the small intestine and then into the colon and then out through the bowel movement. Now, what can happen, though, is some of these toxins can actually get reabsorbed in the intestine and go back to the liver and create sort of like a cycle of going around from the intestine to the liver back in the intestine. There's actually a medical name for that called enterohepatic recirculation. And a little of that's good, but too much of it isn't good. And of course, one of the ways you keep things moving is make sure you have really good bowel movements and good elimination. But basically, there's lots of nutrients. It's really neat to see the biochemistry of these pathways because they've got it down to taking things like beta-carotene, vitamin C, vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, selenium, zinc, and minerals like copper and manganese in smaller amounts, as well as certain amino acids like N-acetylcysteine and methionine, taurine, and glycine, glutamine. These are all the amino acids that really help phase one and phase two do their job. And there are plenty of places that we will be able to help people find where to get the products they need to do this. And there are many, many companies that sell these products. Basically, you get a pretty good chance of covering a bit of it, just getting a good multiple vitamin mineral. And so then let's look at the intestine, because the intestine does the exact same thing. And we're talking about the small intestine and part of the large intestine. Actually, the toxins that are coming through our food, the intestinal lining cells have this phase one and phase two process where they package these toxins so that they can then be either taken back to the liver and passed back out through the bile or directly excreted back out into the lumen of the intestine. But a lot of people aren't aware of the fact the intestine actually has a third pathway, and some people call it phase three, and it's a very interesting thing. It just involves a glycoprotein called, and I don't know why they call it this, but it's called antiporter, A-N-T-I-P-O-R-T-E-R. But the antiporter system of the small intestine will actually take toxins that have gotten into the intestinal lining cells and pump them back out into the gut lumen again so as to slow down the speed with which these toxins are getting in the cell. And this antiporter or phase three is actually found in the tip of the little villi in the that are, you know, the intestinal lining is, you know, if you spread it out, it's the size of a basketball court, and it's all of these in villi, just like looking at seaweed in the water that has the ability to move, and it's very dynamic and vital. But the very tips of all these little villi are loaded with these antiporter molecules, and they're also loaded with the cytochrome P450 enzymes, like the 3A4, which is such a good detoxifying enzyme, is right there on the tip. So our intestinal lining will actually pick up toxins, will transport it right back to the surface, where these enzymes, as well as the brush border enzymes, will try to do something to that toxin. So we are constantly in a state of moving toxins from inside the cells to outside the cells and then trying to eliminate them through sweat and urination and elimination through the lungs and the bowels.
Leonard, would you talk just a second about how easy it is to destroy the brush border and the villi, and that many people, for example, people that are sensitive to gluten. Just talk a little bit about how the villi are damaged.
Oh, yeah. Well, you mentioned two things, and you mentioned gluten specifically, and I just want to say it's really critical for anybody that's having either neurologic symptoms, ranging from migraines to possibly depression, OCD, anything, probably should be checked for gluten, because it has a severe effect on the gut lining in terms of creating a immunologic war going on in the gut lining. It's had so many names, it's ridiculous, celiac disease, celiac sprue, and it was just the history of trying to figure out what was really going on. But now, fortunately, I think they just call it gluten sensitivity, which means any grains that contain gluten, which are principally wheat and barley and rye, but I'm sure there's other grains. And, of course, now we're finding out that even rye and barley have other molecules in them that are similar to gluten that tend to do the same thing. But the bottom line is, if you are genetically predisposed, and there are certain genotypes that are predisposed to gluten sensitivity, we'll just stick with that one. And it's like DQ8 and DQ2, but there's a whole series of other genetic possibilities. But the bottom line is if you're having trouble with digestion, it's really worth looking at the blood enzymes, not enzymes, but the blood for anti-gliadin antibodies and anti-transglutaminase antibodies. But the fact is they may not be in the blood before they're in the saliva or in the bowel movement. So, and this is like brand new stuff. There's a website out there called enterolab.com that's actually looking at the bowel movement for anti-gliadin antibodies, and those are the antibodies to gluten, because the fraction of gluten is just a polypeptide chain, which is a string of amino acids. It does get partly chopped up by our enzymes, but if you don't have enough of them, then this gliadin fraction, which I think is like 31 or 33 amino acid peptide chain, will create anti-gliadin antibodies, and then those antibodies do cross-react with other things, but they also cause a lot of inflammation in the gut lining itself. So if people are sensitive to gluten or wheat, they really need to probably go on a gluten-free diet for sure, maybe indefinitely, or at least for 2 or 3 months. I do believe there's a subset of people, by the way, that probably have some sensitivity and then they get over it. But by and large, if you've got anti-gliadin antibodies, you should assume that you probably will have it whenever you introduce wheat or gluten-containing products in your diet. But what happens, what Donna was mentioning, is this brush border along the surface of the small bowel are enzymes that help right from the beginning to digest and break down food. And if you've got a bacterial imbalance in your gut where you've got bacteria growing in there that are somewhat pathogenic or disease-causing, and if you don't have enough of the right beneficial bacteria in there, that will cause what I would liken them to a mild sunburn of the intestinal lining. If you look at it microscopically, that's about what it looks like. And it's a similar mechanism. If you stay out in the sun too long, just the energy of the sun will burn the skin, and your skin becomes more permeable, more painful. Well, if you've got either food sensitivities or well-documented food allergies, which are more serious than a sensitivity, or if you've got bacterial or microbial imbalances, because it isn't just bacteria, it can be virus, it can be fungi and parasites. But if you've got this imbalance and you've knocked your brush border enzymes down and you're inflaming the surface of the bowel, that's what's affectionately known as leaky gut syndrome or dysbiosis. And there's a very simple test to see whether you have that problem. You actually drink a combination of lactulose and mannitol, which are two sugars, and then they actually collect your urine. And by looking at the ratio of lactulose to mannitol, they can see if you've got an increase in leakiness of your gut or an increase in intestinal permeability. Like the L over M ratio should be like 0.03 or less. And it happens very commonly with all kinds of foods that people eat will cause an increase in their intestinal permeability. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to cause a major problem, but it certainly can, depending on what you eat and how reactive your immunity is.
I wanted to add something to that. You know, we have a product called Whole Grain Biotic, and it's a fermented liquid, and it's made with wheat and rye, but oats, barley, and so on. And people might look at that and think, well, I'm gluten intolerant, I can't have this. But what this product, what this liquid is really made from are these grains are pulled together from the field, and then this generation of bacteria are isolated off these grains. They happen to be grain-loving bacteria. So they're very effective at digesting gluten, for example. And what we have done for quite some time now is encourage people to actually drink a couple of times a day about 3 ounces of this whole grain biotic. And then after several weeks, a month or so, they no longer have that sensitivity to gluten because they've now introduced a lot of gluten-loving bacteria, grain-loving bacteria to the digestive tract because that's really what determines. I mean, one of the reasons people are so gluten intolerant today is they lack this healthy inner ecosystem with these great bacteria in them. I'm a perfect myself because I used to be terribly sensitive to any type of gluten and now could have it if I wanted to. I still don't. I'm not a, you know, we don't, in Bud Ecology, we're not into bread. We prefer people go more into the quinoa and millet, buckwheat, and amaranth as the grain-like seeds and stay away from flour products for the most part. But, you know, if you're out in a restaurant or there's a special time where you just feel like having a little bread, if you have those gluten-loving bacteria inside of you, you'll digest them. So I think one of the biggest reasons we have so much intolerance today is we simply lack this healthy inner ecosystem today.
No, I would definitely agree with that. And I think that anybody that has issues with their intestines, or actually the truth is it can be anything from chronic fatigue to fibromyalgia to psoriasis or atopic dermatitis or all kinds of symptoms. One of the classic tests that we do believe in doing for that is food sensitivity testing, looking for the IgG4 antibodies, and people will not uncommonly have like 2+ or 3+ to wheat and eggs and dairy and soy and corn, frequently because a lot of those are most commonly eaten. And I think it's even becoming more acceptable in mainstream allergy and immunology that to do elimination diet or rotational diet. Well, you do two things. One, on a rotational diet, whatever you eat on day one, you don't eat again till day four, and you stay on that for a while, and it sort of calms your intestinal immunity down in general. And the ones that you're 2, 3, and 4+ to, you avoid those for at least one, preferably 2 or 3 months, then reintroduce them in a very small amount, and you may develop a tolerance to it again. And that may go for quite a while until you sort of forget about it and start eating too much, and then you've got the problem again. So it's similar to the way they do desensitization for like feathers and mold and cat hair and whatnot by injecting very small amounts in the skin until your body becomes tolerant again. The whole key is to develop an immune system that's tolerant and balanced. It's fully vigilant, fully awake, ready to do what it needs to do, but not attack everything that comes across the barrier. That's where the tolerance part or the flexible, intelligent part of the immune system comes in that I think is so critical.
Leonard, I think what's so interesting about this discussion and Donna, the idea of how bacteria can help us heal as well, is that while a lot of Body Ecology followers know this about food because the connection between food and our health, there are still a lot of people who get a symptom and are, instead of thinking about, well, what am I eating or might I be intolerant to something, are running off to the doctor and maybe even taking drugs and still continuing to eat those foods that are creating the symptoms.
Right.
I think it's also interesting what you said about people with migraines, OCD, or depression, that while many people can sort of bridge to the fact that eczema or some other type of body symptom might be caused by the food they're eating, still a lot of people are just getting to grasp this fact that our mental states and our emotional states can be caused by the foods that we're eating. So I appreciate that you brought that up today because I think it's going to help a lot of people start thinking about all of the symptoms they're having, not just the physical symptoms. One of the things that I wanted to ask is that one of the things I love about all of the articles that you've written for Body Ecology is that you talk so much about the natural aspect of how we can heal, and you have a whole system of practices that you've talked about being sort of what you would consider best practice for detoxification. Can you talk about what those are and why they're so important?
Okay, I'll be glad to. I think I'd like to start off, though, it's like everything is a spectrum. And if you're if you've got significant toxification in your body, then it's probably worth looking at finding a practitioner that can help you with this. And there are several places I can mention later where I think you can find people like that. But to do basic challenge tests either orally or intravenously with chelating agents, just to find out how much lead or cadmium or mercury or arsenic or aluminum, things like that, that are in your body, because if they're in there, and depending on what you've got along with it, if you're fairly healthy and you're just finding it as an incidental finding, I think you can do a very natural approach, possibly with some oral chelating agents from time to time. If you're fairly far along in terms of any significant illness, I think it's probably important to go ahead and try to get the levels of the toxins down. So intravenous EDTA chelation has been shown to be very beneficial for lead and cadmium and many other toxins. A lot of people aren't aware of it, but iron can be a toxin, and a lot of people have very high iron levels. And if they do, the EDTA chelation is good for that. The oral chelation generally is directed more towards DMSA and DMPS, which are just the acronyms for a couple of molecules that are prescription. So is EDTA. All of this now you have to have prescriptions for. But you can take either DMSA or DMPS orally, like 3 days a week, and then skip 2 weeks and then do it again. Or other people do just very low doses. There's many different protocols, and we don't have the time to go into that. But I do think it's worth investigating if you've got a significant toxic load of these toxic minerals. And you're not going to know that, actually, unless you get a challenge test. You could do just a red blood cell test, and it may show them there. If they're there, it's pretty likely you probably have them in your fat stores, your muscles, and throughout your body. But if you do a challenge test, you'll see possibly numbers that are quite a bit higher, and that's not to be alarming. It's just to point out that when you put these chelators in the body, they're like magnets. They pull it out of storage areas, and we still don't know what the damage they do sitting in storage areas are. I do think, though, it's worth getting the levels down, either with IV or oral chelation. I do think there's a lot of natural things to add to that, and for those that don't feel like they want to see a practitioner or do the chelation route that way, you actually can do a lot of things. I mean, infrared sauna is a very valuable tool. The sauna actually heats up the body. The infrared penetrates the skin about a centimeter, and it seems to pull out more toxins possibly than the conventional radiant saunas, although some people argue that there isn't much difference. The comfort difference is enough to have people try the infrared, because you typically don't go over 140, 150 degrees at the max Fahrenheit, whereas with the radiant saunas that you see in a lot of gyms, they get up to 160, 170. And everything's a question of balance. Too much heat too long can be actually injurious, I think. But with the infrared sauna, I would generally recommend people start out with 10 to 20 minutes and work up to an hour, but probably every 15 to 20 minutes maybe hop out of it and hop in a shower and cool down for a minute and then get back in. But I've had patients actually lower their mercury levels just by doing the sauna and changing their diet. So I know that it works. Along with infrared sauna, having impeccable bowel function, I think, is absolutely critical. So colon hydrotherapy, I think, is another tool for detoxification that can be very valuable. I think both from the point of view of removing toxins, but also think colon hydrotherapy actually does somehow or another stimulate your colon's normal peristaltic response so that it contracts better for several days, sometimes weeks, after a colon hydrotherapy treatment. So, and I think a lot of people have no idea how much retained fecal matter they have in them until they do a colon hydrotherapy. And I do believe that it's proportional to what you're eating. If you're on a high-fiber diet with really adequate hydration and exercise, you should have fairly large eliminations. And that is a major part of detoxifying, because we know that the bacteria in the gut actually absorb a lot of the toxins that are in our diet, certainly the mercury, lead, cadmium, arsenic, things like that. But it's quite possible they're absorbing the fat-soluble toxins as well. Since we know that at least 80% of the bowel movement is bacteria, by getting them out frequently, that's just one major way to get toxins out of the body. I think they've now shown, too, that everything from massage to acupuncture to shiatsu, working on points of the body, actually do some cell signaling right from the surface of the skin that affects the cells and whole networks of cells throughout the body to help the detoxification process, just like using dry, natural, bristle brushes to brush the body has been shown to help move toxins. Certainly certain practices, I think yoga is certainly one of them, because doing the various asanas, you can actually feel the different areas of your body tighten up. And a lot of the tightness in our body, please don't shoot the messenger, but they are due to molecules that are stuck in the tissues, and they can range from toxins like the fat-soluble toxins or the heavy metal toxins, or it can be things that are called AGEs, which are advanced glycosylation end products, or proteins that have sugars attached to them that the body has trouble getting out of the body. That's why the cooked food is still always a little bit of an issue, although as Donna and I have discussed many times, I think it's up to the individual, and if you're in a very cold climate, I don't think people would do as well on a completely raw diet. But the fact, and it depends on what kind of cooking you're doing too. I don't think all cooking creates these advanced glycosylation products, but certainly cooking meat with saturated fat and using sugars, like basting ham with sugar, you know, sugar-coated meats, those are typical age. The acronym is AGES, A-G-E-S. Again, it stands for Advanced Glycosylation End Product. And whenever protein, fat, and sugar are stuck together, it's a problem for the body. So it will eventually break it down, or it will store it somewhere. So I think the more you move your body, the more you break things like that up. And then, of course, exercise itself is probably one of the best detoxification practices anybody can do. And I do recommend doing a combination of both aerobic, which can be anything from cycling to low-impact elliptical cross-training machines that are in gyms, to treadmills, to swimming, something that gets your heart rate in a training heart range, which is typically about 80%. The way to find your training heart range is you take 220 minus your age and multiply it by 70 and by 80%, and that'll give you a range like from 112 to 128, where you should keep your heartbeat while you're training. Now, that's for just plain aerobic training, and I think a few times a week to do that's very good. A lot of people now are pointing out that doing more of an anaerobic exercise, which is pushing hard for shorter periods of time, has been shown to release growth hormone and testosterone better. But I wouldn't do that unless you were working your way up to it. And you can do that biking or swimming or on a elliptical cross trainer, where you go slow and then take a minute and you go faster and then slow back down. But gradually increase it to the point that within your own training range. And if you're older and if you're not used to exercising, you really definitely ought to get a professional trainer, because there are doctors now that even write exercise prescriptions. And certainly if you've had any problems with your heart or anything like that, it'd be very smart to get monitored or get a stress test before starting an exercise program. But obviously we need both to work out our muscles through resistance training, and we need some combination of running at a training pace and then having sprints between that to make you, to stimulate more of your hormones. And a combination of that with either Tai Chi or yoga, I think, is probably, at the end of the day, one of the most significant things you can do is exercise. We certainly know that you can increase the amount of stem cells that are released from your bone marrow and your blood go up six to sevenfold just from exercising. So I've come to believe that the reason people that exercise tend to be healthy is because they're mobilizing toxins, they're sweating them out, they're breathing them out. The extra prostaglandins actually help stimulate colonic activity, so people that exercise tend to have better bowel movements. You stay well hydrated, and so you eliminate a lot of toxins like that.
I'd like to add to something that you back up a little bit and talk about food preparation, Winter, because that's what we specialize in as food. But one of the things we stress in body ecology is that you proteins, for example, they either need to be eaten raw or rare, like the Japanese eat raw fish, raw sashimi, that's easier to digest, and rare, you know, maybe something just seared. But most of the time we like for people to do very slow cooking at low temperatures so that they don't get those advanced fermentation end products. And an example of, you know, chicken, for example, I will never buy chicken out and, you know, even like a place like Whole Foods where they have these lovely, great-smelling rotisserie chickens because they're always cooked to death. And
right.
It's too hard to digest. But the right way to cook chicken is to keep it at a very low temperature, around, say, 275 even. And it doesn't take that much longer to cook your chicken at a low temperature, but it cooks slower and it's a little bit slower, but at a slower temperature, it's much, much more tender and juicy that way. And then you another mistake people make is they wait until the meat or the chicken, for example, is completely cooked, and then they take it out of the oven, where there's so much heat in the meat itself that you should actually remove the chicken when it's just very, very light, mildly pink, and let it sit and rest, and then the resting takes it the rest of the way. So there are little tips like that, the way we prepare food. And you're taking a raw food, for example, a raw vegetable, and fermenting it makes it so much more digestible and has all the benefits of the wonderful microflora. The preparation of food is critical, and I think that's another area where we shine in helping people get on the right track. So I just wanted to throw that into.
Yeah, well, I would completely agree with that, and I think that we all, apparently the number is something like 25 tons of food is what we, the average GI tract of a human being is exposed to 25 tons of food over a lifetime, and it's certainly the largest load of potential antigens and toxins of any other part of the body by weight. And certainly if we don't prepare the food right, we're creating a toxic environment right from the beginning. And of course, that's why I'm here with you on the phone today, because I really do believe what you're doing with the food is so critical, and people just don't even know until they've tried something different. And the fact is, we get away with so much for so long that we don't really realize what it is that's hurting us. But when you actually do go to a more plant-based diet and then handle the animal products the way you're referring to, I think people really do feel that they're getting better. And I just can't tell you the number of people I've seen that just get off of all of the trans fats and partially hydrogenated fats and all the processed foods. I mean, most people just don't get it. That processed foods, I don't care what they are, even if they're organic, are still processed, and it's something foreign to your immune system. And they've actually shown now that the cells of our body have receptors on them that literally can determine whether this food, it's one of three categories. It's either well-received, it's sort of neutral, or it's negatively perceived as something that's not good. And they fit on the receptors of the cells. The protein kinases take it into the side of the cell, which then other molecule messengers take it to the nucleus, and the nucleus of the cell either then does, through transcription, translation, sends out messages to make proteins to help digest good food or to make proteins to start fighting and calling the immune system into a high alert because something's coming in there that doesn't belong there. And this goes on in all of us every single day. but it's cumulative, and you're talking about, you know, we have 10 trillion cells, so it takes quite a while for people sometimes to really realize that what they're eating is really poisoning them, and that might be the simplest form of detoxification we can do, is just really work on eating the right food. And then on top of that, eating less of the right food. I mean, I think I would be remiss if I didn't point out one of the best detoxification pathways of all is eating about 30% less than you think you want, because that is the only thing that's actually been proven to prolong life, is caloric restriction. However, it's not just caloric restriction, it's with optimum nutrition. So if you do restrict calories, you got to be really sure that you're eating a wide variety of vegetables, seeds and nuts, sprouted grains, sprouted legumes, or cooked the right way, some balance of all that. And that's why people need to really, I think, study your diet more, Donna, because I think you do have the missing link between being a raw foodist and somebody that's on the standard American diet. I think there's no question people that get on a raw food diet, it's tremendously detoxifying, and they get better for periods of time. And then depending on their constitution and their genetic makeup, they may do well on that or they may stop doing so well. The point is, we as a human culture have known for thousands of years appropriate ways to prepare food that involve cooking, whether it's marinating, steaming, lightly boiling, using crock pots, whatever, and that's your part of it, not mine. But that's the key, is to make sure that the food we eat is of high quality, but then don't overeat either.
I know. I'd like to put a plug in here for the book that you and I are doing that will be out this year. It's called the Baby Boomer Diet, Body Ecology's Baby Boomer Diet, and you were talking about calorie restriction. We, I think, do an excellent job explaining what that really means, how to do it right, how to live much longer. But one of the things I wanted to throw in here, too, is that we, you know, a lot of times we go along just fine. We feel great and have plenty of energy, and then all of a sudden we stop feeling good, and we're going through a detoxification or period of cleansing, and that's natural because the body is designed to cleanse. And one of the things that I'm trying to get people to be tuned into is when their body is going through this detoxification stage, which will always happen throughout our life, this gift, this ability to push toxins out is a gift that we've been given to keep our bodies clean. So when we go into a detoxification stage, we should be assisting our body, and one of the things that we recommend then is to eat more of a very clean, vegetarian, raw diet, lots of fermented foods, lots of fermented liquids, you know, fresh vegetables and salads, and maybe a little bit of maybe one, you know, cooked vegetable meal, maybe with some quinoa or some sprouted quinoa. Things are very, if people feel that they're weak without animal protein, we say don't eat the animal protein, but just take a broth or take something like a miso soup. You can make miso soup with a kombu stock by just putting a piece of kombu in water and simmering that. If you want to go one more step, you can add some shiitake mushrooms to it, simmer that. And then one more step, if you don't want it to be vegetarian, is to put in some dried fish flakes, simmer that for about 20 minutes together, and then strain out those fish flakes, the kombu and the shiitake mushrooms, and you have this wonderful, nourishing, strengthening stock. Because when you're going through a cleanse, you've got to still provide your body with lots of energy. That's one thing I've kind of repeated over and over and over again through this whole workshop, Leonard, is that we first and foremost have to create energy.
I totally agree.
And so you got to keep yourself strong while you're cleansing. Sometimes you can get too weak on
absolutely. And that's why I think another product, assuming people aren't sensitive to it, is undenatured whey, because whey contains a lot of the sulfur-containing amino acids, which are exactly the ones that are involved in the phase two detoxification of the small bowel, of the liver, and, in fact, of all the cells of the body. So, yes, you need adequate protein while you're detoxing. Otherwise, you can get sicker from it. So, and you can certainly do that by a combination of whey protein or rice and pea protein. There's different kinds of protein powders that you can do
ethereal grasses.
Right.
Like we have the Vitality Super Green, which is just a green powder, but it's giving you a lot of protein from that. And we're actually going to be bringing out a whey protein shortly that's fermented whey protein. So, and then I'm usually sending people to One Green Mom to get the whey, an undenatured whey. There's so much whey on the market today, but
right.
it's not very good quality. And you mentioned undenatured. That's exactly, you know, what I try to stress too is, You want the protein to be intact. You don't want it to be undenatured or destroyed, basically. Would you talk about the effect of sleeping? Because, you know, that people are not sleeping today. I see that all the time, and I think it's partly because we are so toxic and certainly because we're under stress. And then there's tremendous toxins produced by the body. I've talked earlier about the toxins coming in from the outside, but the toxins that our own body produces from inside, those endogenous toxins that come from lack of sleep, which makes us feel stressed out. We don't handle stress well when we don't sleep well. And then, of course, stress itself produces tremendous amount of toxins in the body. I think we should just talk about that a little bit.
Okay. Well, that's one of my favorite topics is talking about sleep because it's. I definitely think it's the missing ingredient for most people, whether you're doing a detox or not, and basically, I think what happens is we just basically have gotten way too busy between cell phones and TVs and computers and whatnot. We have a fair amount of electromagnetic stress from these things, but one of the things that can happen, and this is sort of the gut brain connection. I do want to point out in this before we get off the phone, if we have 10 trillion cells, it's pretty well accepted now. We have 100 trillion bacteria, viruses, fungi, parasites, whatever, call them microbes, 100 trillion microbes in our intestinal tract. So there's 10 times more of them than there are us. Now we know, just the latest thing from last week, we've got over 1,000 different bacteria on our skin. And they're different in the armpit than they are in the front of your forearm or the front of your thigh. So we are a super organism. I mean, if you stop and think about it. And that's why the whole body ecology approach is so critical, is to manage these organisms. And if you manage the ones on the inside, I don't think you need to worry much about the ones on the outside. But here we go with the sleep. If you've got some kind of a dysbiosis, leaky gut, some sort of gut issue, and you've got enough inflammation going on in your gut to upregulate the production of these inflammatory markers that are called cytokines. They've got interesting names. They're called interleukins, like interleukin 1 and 2 and TNF-alpha and interferon gamma. But these are all like the police running around with at least the siren on and a yellow light, if not a red light. They're signaling to the body that there's inflammation going on. So if you've got that going on, those cytokines cross the blood-brain barrier. They go, and of course the brain makes their own cytokines, but these inflammatory cytokines in the brain will upregulate the production of cortisol as well because of the inflammation. So somewhere between the cortisol and the inflammatory cytokines, the tryptophan that's in our diet, that's an essential amino acid, that's the precursor for making melatonin, will not get converted to 5-hydroxytryptophan, which that converts to serotonin, and that converts to melatonin. So if you've got enough inflammation going on in your body, you can just forget about making melatonin. And if you don't make enough melatonin, then you're certainly not going to sleep well. If you've got optimum melatonin levels, you will actually have several episodes of REM sleep throughout the night. So you cycle. Everything is pulsing. You go to deep sleep, which is delta. It's like 0 to 4 cycles a minute. Your brain's totally still and quiet. But you'll pop out of that into REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement sleep. And it's this popping back and forth that actually has to do with the thalamus and the hypothalamus releasing the pre-hormones that regulate everything from thyroid to adrenal to sex hormones. So if you think about it, if you're not pulsing your REM sleep at night, you're not balancing your hormones. And not only that, you're not sleeping either. And if you don't sleep, you will become sort of sympathetically overdriven. You get up the next day, and that's when you find out you're having to drink too much coffee to stay awake, and you're falling asleep at work and one thing and the other. So I think it's critical that we learn a lot of the basic things to do for healthy sleep. There's a great book out there called Lights Out by a guy named Bent Formby. He's a PhD in molecular biology and biochemistry both. And the lady that does the book with him is named T.S. Wiley, and she's a cultural anthropologist. But they've looked at the sort of the history of the human race, particularly in higher latitudes where there is a winter, where people actually almost appear to be hibernating like bears do, in the sense that we're very active in the summer. We get the sunlight, we get the vitamin D, we eat more fruit, we gain weight, in the sense that we're just outdoors more and more active. And then in the fall and the winter, we sort of retreat inside, and basically it's almost like hibernating. But the bottom line of all this is that that's what we used to do. Today, though, it's very different because the lights are always on and there's always sugar there, you know, in the form of carbohydrates. And they feel it's the combination of these two things that really are disrupting our sleep cycle. And so they have many things in that book that suggest how to optimize sleep. And one of which is to wear a sleep mask. A lot of people don't do that, but just simply covering your eyes can help. But they've actually shown that it's good to be in a dark room, and if you need a flashlight or something, get a very weak one to follow your way to the bathroom if you need it, because just getting up to go to the bathroom and having light hit your retina can shut off the melatonin, and that's the end of the sleep right there. So they've actually shown that if they've got somebody completely covered up and put a flashlight on their leg, just the light of a flashlight on the leg, they can watch the blood melatonin level drop. These are people that have IV catheters in them, and they're measuring constant melatonin levels.
If you don't sleep well, you don't have enough energy during the day, either you're grabbing things to bring your energy level up, or, you know, you're just exhausted all day long, and when you don't have enough energy, you can't cleanse. That's
right.
Perfect.
That's true.